Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
All right, welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we are exposing the mysteries of executive function. As always, I'm here with our host, Sucheta Kamath. Good morning, my dear friend. This is going to be a great conversation. I can't wait for you to kick it off.
All right, Todd, I know you're very committed to your field and you're amazing. And if you want a second career, you might find inspiration in the guest that we're going to have today. An extremely well-celebrated and remarkable educator. So think about second calling here.
Okay, if you insist.
Well, you always are such a good teacher to me. So yes, I see a lot of traits in you. But as we talk about education, recently I spoke at the Georgia Association for Positive Behavior Support Conference, and almost close to 1,600 educators had gathered together to talk about discipline problems in schools in Georgia. And the keynote speaker was talking about bringing compassion and handling challenges in children. And some of the stats are horrific. Apparently, we are engaging with children, particularly when they become unmanageable, that there are at least 150,000 incidences where students are being punished, are receiving physical punishment from a teacher. So that is just horrific, right? So managing kids in the classroom is a really challenging thing. And when it doesn't go well, but most often it's rewarding. But how do we convert or change our interactions with students and make all of those interactions rewarding? And that's why we have this amazing guest today. Her name is Kim Bearden. She's the co-founder, executive director, and language arts teacher at the highly acclaimed Ron Clark Academy right in our backyard, an innovative middle school and educational training facility here in Atlanta. Over 62,000 educators from all around the world have visited Kim's classroom and have attended her workshops to learn better ways to promote success in their own schools. Now, over the past 30 years, she has been a teacher, instructional lead teacher, curriculum director, school board member, staff development trainer, and middle school principal. So you can certainly see her flexibility and innovativeness as she has played different roles and served different communities as a leader. And Kim is a best-selling author of two books. Her newest book is Talk to Me, Find the Right Words to Inspire, Encourage, and Get Things Done. One of the most amazing things that our listeners would enjoy knowing about Kim is that in 2016, Kim was honored at the White House by President Obama for being inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame. So I will say she's my third teacher as a friend who I know. So I am famous by association. And she was selected from over 70,000 nominations as the Disney American Teacher Awards Outstanding Humanities Teacher. And the Milken Family Foundation selected her for the Award for Excellence in Education. So she is also the winner of the Influence Her Award, the UGA's Outstanding Educator Award, and the TurkNet Character Award for Servant Leadership. So we can go on and on celebrating her, but I can't wait to welcome her to the podcast. So Kim, welcome to Full Prefrontal. Can't wait to talk about executive function, classroom management, and inspiring learners and teachers as well.
Well, thank you for having me today.
And I know you jumped through hoops to get here, so managing daily crisis is not at all unusual to you. But before we jump into the topic of your expertise, I wanted to start off with executive functions, since that is our main area of how do we manage ourselves as we manage our life's trajectory and goals and focus and intentionality. Would you share with us a little bit about your own executive function and how were you as a learner and thinker when you were younger? And what kind of classroom you found most engaging? And what was that particular teacher or group of teachers doing that influenced you the most?
Well, as a student, I was one of those kids who loved school. I loved everything from the smell of paper to the sound of a pencil across the page.
And I love that.
Yeah, I just was fully immersed. I was very fortunate to have very positive experiences in school. And so that was just something I loved to learn. I was the eager kid sitting in the front row who couldn't wait to learn the next thing and the next new idea. But when I think about the teachers who stood out to me, there was a combination of things. Then somehow would do something creative, something a little bit different, something made me look at the world in a different way. And also those teachers that I felt like they didn't just see me as a student, they saw me as a human being. Those teachers who seemed to know a little bit about me, who, you know, would greet me with a smile, you know, just that warmth in their classroom, that feeling that it was a home away from home. And that's something I really work hard to replicate in my classroom here. And then those teachers who challenged me, I think it's really, I know that if you're bored, if you're not being challenged, you know, school is not a place where, you know, that's where a lot of issues happen too. And for me, I felt like in my classes, I was always challenged to learn more, to be better, to do more, but done with the support. And so it's interesting for me how my experiences as a student really molded who I became as a teacher. Now, I was one of the fortunate ones who had a great education growing up, but I really tried to provide that for my students because I want them to feel the same way walking into school that I always felt.
One thing that you and I share is school was a positive experience for me as well. And now that, you know, I have been in this business and have been talking to experts, it has also opened my eyes to this. It had so much to do with the teacher who actually tapped into my inner resources or allowed me to tap into my inner resources. And one thing that you mentioned here, which is also, I think, making classroom home away from home. And that certainly, I think you're talking about the coziness or the feeling of a community where you belong and not a sterile environment. I grew up in India and our classrooms, believe it or not, did not have a single picture, painting, or a scribble on the walls. The walls were pure whitewashed and a blackboard. And the blackboard, the only person that was allowed to write on the blackboard was the teacher. And all the children sat in rows and columns, and the teacher was in front. The teacher never went. The teacher only went to the backbenchers if they were creating trouble. So, and then I came to America and there's overcorrection that every single ounce of the wall is taken up with something creative, but ultimately then you don't know what to focus on. So I've seen both extremes. So let's dive deep into this, the fundamental idea here. So first of all, tell us the story of Ron Academy and what were you and Ron thinking when you decided to co-found the school and what challenges in education were you trying to solve for?
Well, Ron Clark and I met in the year 2000. We were both honored by Disney as Teachers of the Year. And the award was primarily given for creativity and innovation in the classroom. And we just hit it off. We got to spend a year together going to different events, different professional development. And so one day he looked at me and said, you know what, you and I should start a school together one day. Now, teachers say that all the time. You know, if I had my own school, this would be what I would do. And I said, sure, Ron, that sounds great. Didn't really know that it would actually become a reality. But he wrote a book called The Essential 55, and Oprah had highlighted it, which was really exciting. And so he took the money from that book, put it in a foundation, and called me up and said, I'm serious. I'm going to start this school. Will you come to Harlem? And I said, you know what? If you come to Atlanta, I'm in, because Atlanta was my home. And so he came here. We looked at 50 sites all over Atlanta, and we bought a 100-year-old dilapidated old warehouse. It was an eyesore in the community, and we transformed it into a school. But what makes us unique and distinctive, I guess, is that one of the things both of us had a history of doing is doing a lot of professional development for educators. You know, even though I was in the classroom, I'm still in the classroom. I would go to different places. You know, you'd sit in a theater and you'd tell teachers strategies, ideas, implementation, things that they should do. And some teachers would be able to get it, but some teachers, it didn't really translate back to their classrooms because we learn by doing, right? And we learn by seeing things. And so what we realized is that in the world of education, it's very ironic, but there's some real problems with the way we develop teachers, in that teachers go through a professional, they go through their student teaching experience. And in their student teaching experience, they're paired with a teacher, and then that's their real world application. But after that, you could work in a building for 30 years and never again watch another teacher teach. You may have one of the best teachers in the country down the hall, but you go into your silo, you close the door and you have your kids looking at you and you never actually watch that other teacher in action. And so we said, what if we could find the best teachers we could find anywhere? We put them in one building and instead of closing our doors, we opened our doors. What if we allow teachers to come in and sit in our classes, watch us teach learners of all different backgrounds, of all different academic abilities, all different academic skill levels, and watch us teach, not because we're perfect, because there's no such thing as a perfect teacher, but to really let them see what it could be, and then take our methods and ideas back to their classroom. And, you know, if you want to be a master surgeon, you operate beside other surgeons your whole career, or a master carpenter, you build beside carpenters. But in education, you never really get to see masters at their craft. And so we thought it was a great idea. And it has really taken off. We are the only place in the world that we know that does it to the scale that we do. But now we've actually just surpassed over 70,000 educators from around the world who've come to this tiny little warehouse in Southeast Atlanta to sit in our classes and attend our workshops. and take our methods and ideas back to their classrooms. So we like to say we're trying to create a revolution in education, because that teacher in front of the classroom, there's many factors that affect a child's learning, obviously. There's so many factors that are pieces of the puzzle, but one of the greatest pieces of that puzzle is that teacher in front of that classroom. And so if we can provide that support and that training and methodology for those teachers, then we feel like we're having a huge exponential effect upon education.
That's incredible. And, you know, I really like your attention to this one fact that we learn by doing. And after you complete your professional training, you never do enough where other your peers or your supervisor are giving you feedback. And also, like you said, to innovate, you need to kind of really have a good experience in what the problems are. But I feel nowadays teachers are so busy that they do not get enough time to hang back and think about the problems they're running into, because they have to meet deadlines, you know, test often or meet Common Core demands or whatever it is. So I like that you have created this atmosphere where this can be delivered and observed by others as they are. And I'm coming in. I cannot believe it's taken me so long, but I'm coming in February to see you guys in action. So I can't wait.
I'm excited for that. Yeah, and we also really try to, you know, fuel their souls a little bit when they're here too, because you mentioned a lot of the things. You know, we have a lot of teachers who are emotionally broken, and they love children and they want to be everything for their students, but they're just barely treading water. And, you know, a lot of them are working multiple jobs outside of school to be able to pay their bills, and they have paperwork, and sometimes they don't have the leadership support they need. There's just a lot of things that are really, really, really difficult for educators at this day and age. And so we really try to give them that motivation, that inspiration too, in addition to giving them tools to try to help make them more effective and feel that sense of confidence in their classrooms.
I know I have heard you speak as well as I've seen the work. I think you come from a place where you trust that they have the capabilities within them, so they don't need to go get more skills, because that often seems to be the emphasis. But here it's like more effective use of your talents and skills that you have, which is a wonderful way to invite people in, you know.
Well, you know, I tell teachers there's an art and science to teaching, and we know more about the science of teaching than ever before. You know, we know how the brain works. We know how to use data to drive instruction. All those things are incredibly important, and I'm grateful for that knowledge. But there's also an artistry to teaching, and I feel like the artistry is where the passion lies. And those teachers who are artists, you know, they're the ones that have kids who lie in bed at night and go, I can't wait to be in her classroom, or what's he going to do tomorrow? You know, just that. So it is, it's that taking the best of who you are and exuding that passion in your classroom. How do you do that? How do you make your mark in your classroom in a way? Because if you exude passion, people are drawn to it. And so if you're passionate in that classroom for what you're teaching, the students will be engaged.
You talk a lot about dynamic teaching methods, and or Ron Academy, you and Ron are known for inspiring people to infuse dynamism in teaching. So what does that mean to you? And how does that get contextualized in any subject and all subjects? Like, can we maintain this dynamism in all subjects? Because a lot of people are hung up a little bit about that. My content doesn't permit me to dance, or my content doesn't permit me to sing poetry. If I'm teaching math, how can I infuse poetry? You know what I mean? So how do you view this?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. So there's a lot of videos. Many have even gone viral of some of the things in our classrooms. And there is a lot of music and there's a lot of movement. To be clear, I can't dance worth a flip. And so you don't have to be able to dance. But, you know, we do use a lot of songs and chants and things like that. But that's not by any means the whole scope of what we do. I think that those things are just very catchy, and that people see the joy in our children's eyes. And so those are the things that people tend to share more. But music is, you know, a very powerful tool for learning and for the development of the brain and for memorization too of content, so that you are able to dig deeper after you have the memorization of those facts. So there is a lot of music in our classroom, but there's also a lot of conversation. We teach, when educators come, they watch how sometimes a teacher would just throw out a question, but our students then take it from there, the depth of questioning, how they engage in conversation, teaching our students how to talk about their learning. They, you know, how to stand up, you know, even if you're an introverted child, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have thoughts and ideas to share. And so we help our kids build that confidence to be able to, you know, get up, look others in the eye and speak on even what they got right, but also why they got something wrong, or talk about their learning process. That's something that people, when they come here, is a huge takeaway. Also, we really work on there should never be a lesson where kids are just sitting there for a whole hour and somebody's just talking at them. You know, it's how do you engage lots of different methods? Mm. The discipline is a piece of that too. I mean, we're very big on discipline, manners, respect, and we balance that with the creativity, the passion, the enthusiasm, the joy. And that's how you're able to have really tough learning here, very academically rigorous, because it's safe and structured so they can learn. But there's the passion, the joy, the enthusiasm. So they want to learn. They're willing to dig in and do the work that needs to be done. And so we also teach teachers, yes, you don't have to jump on a tabletop, even though Ron and I are known to do that. you don't have to do that to be passionate in your classroom. But we do teach teachers some of those presentation skills about movement and the way that you just even things when you're everything from your body language to your facial expressions to the intonation, you know, in your voice and inflection and things like that. We also teach that some too, because everybody can is seeing that scene from Ferris Bueller's Day Off when the teacher's at the front of the board and he's just like anyone, he's droning on and on about falling asleep. We teach teachers how to not do that as well, because then they are more engaging and more dynamic as presenters as well.
So Kim, I want to kind of switch attention to one element that you talked about, which is, as you talk about it, I see your principles in three folds. So first is, I think one of the wonderful things you bring in to the students is this opportunity to engage with great passion. When the teacher is passionate, the students will feel the passion. And when you feel the passion, you're inspired to reach out to your inner meaning. Second thing I see is the concept of the discipline, manners, and respect. I want to spend some time talking about that. And the third part, we'll talk about this, actually, in development of knowledge. But can you talk a little bit about what role does having rules play in helping children grow? And am I right that you started off by saying that, you know, Ron had written this book, but I guess you have 55 or I don't know more, but strict rules that kids are expected to abide by?
So our kids may tell you there's 155, but really the word rules, I prefer the word expectations and protocols, how we treat each other, how we interact with each other. And so it's things like if you bump somebody in the hall, what do? You know, oh, after you. Oh, excuse me, after you. You know, so we do teach them some social graces as well. And so I think that's important. But it's also things like, how do you give a firm handshake? How do you look somebody in the eye and those kinds of things as well? How to express appreciation, the importance of that. But one of the things that I think that you don't have to have 55 rules by any means, but one of the things that we're very intentional about sharing teachers is that you have to be very specific about expectations. You know, when I was a beginning teacher 33 years ago now, I remember I was told to need three rules: be respectful, be on time, and be prepared. Well, I learned very quickly that first year, and most first teachers struggle. I struggled too. Here's the problem with that, though, Suchetta, is that respect looks very different to different people. And so if you tell kids just be respectful, some kids, that's where you get that kind of thing sometimes in classes. Well, I am respectful. What? What am I doing? I didn't do anything wrong. What? But then the teacher's perceiving, you know, your tone of voice is disrespectful. Your body language is disrespectful. And so there's a lack of understanding. And sometimes a child really is perplexed. Like, what? This is how I talk to people. And so what we do here is we're very, very specific. It's, you know, the more specific.
Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah. So we do a lot of role playing with kids at the beginning of the school year. I say, if you were standing up here presenting to me, how would you want me to be sitting? How would you want the audience to be sitting? Right. Like, you know, I said, pretend you're up here. I said, what would you want everybody in the audience to look like? And so they're all, you know, they all sit up real straight and they look really enthusiastic. I said, exactly. That's sitting. That's being a respectful participant, right? You know, but what if I'm doing this? You know, and I'll sit in a chair and I'll slump way down. I put my head on my hand. I said, if you're giving the presentation of your lifetime and I'm doing this, what would you take from that? Well, you look like you're bored. You look like you're not interested. You look like you don't care about me. You know, those kind of things. So you start to help them understand. So see, that is why in this classroom, when someone's speaking, we sit up, we make eye contact, we look at them. And so you're teaching them also social cues and social graces, but you're also teaching them, you know, the reason why, but what the expectation is. So we talk a lot about what does respect look like and what does it sound like? You know, if I were to ask you a question and you answered it, how can you answer it? What sounds more respectful? Yes, or yes, ma'am, in the South sometimes, right? Or yeah, you know, what sounds better? Yeah, you know, they'll all agree, well, yes sounds better. Exactly. So do you see that's why, you know, so we kind of break things down in that way and then they start to understand it. So the more specific you are, then the more specific results you're going to get. And it makes a big difference. And so
yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And so then we don't have those escalation issues. A third of the students that we accept to come to the school actually had some kind of history of behavior issues before they came. But if they were to come here, you were to watch our classes, you would think I'm lying to you because those issues go away. One, because we're very nurturing and we love our kids. So that's the other thing is that discipline meted out, if there's no respect given by the teacher too, and there's no love from the teacher, then that makes it more challenging. You know, my students here, they know that I care about them. You know, I eat lunch with them. I sit and talk to them. I visited at home of every kid in the school. We do home visits. I've, you know, go to their ball games or, you know, sit and talk to them about what they care about. So when I am disappointed or upset with them, they receive it because they know, oh, she wants me to be better. It's not that she doesn't like me. It's that she doesn't like the behavior. And they're able to distinguish between the two things. And so that when we're talking about discipline here, relationship building is huge.
So lovely. Yes. And I think it's so amazing as I'm hearing you speak. These are, I mean, we often underestimate or dismiss. These are good human practices, isn't it? Like yeah. Something that your parents would teach you, how to be a good citizen of the world. And what I'm hearing you say that you're concretizing it, but you're also translating that to the students. So there's no left for interpretation or inferring or extrapolating and then say, oh, I didn't know you wanted me to be sitting straight in your class. You know, there's no ambiguity about that. No, I expected. Did you hear my expectations? And when I expect you, I'm actually elevating you in my eyes because I'm giving you the parameters by which you can hold yourself. Correct?
Exactly.
So tell me, do children understand the distinction between these rules? Because they have grown up with rules, but they think that rules are adults imposing some arbitrary ideas on me. And now you're making a little puppet out of me. You know, like that's when the discipline problems begin. So this art of cajoling them into coming on your side and getting them to see the value, how do you do that?
Well, I think the part of it is that a lot of them, you know, when we talk about what were the things that have happened in class or that they've experienced where they did feel unsafe or they felt unsettled or they felt bullied or they felt, you know, those kinds of things, when those have happened, how did they feel? Well, we want to create an environment where you feel safe, where you can't wait to come to school every day, where you feel supported, where you feel loved, those kinds of things. And the way that we go about doing that is that this is the way we treat each other. And we do talk about it. We don't want anybody to be fake. And we even talk about, I say, here's the thing. So a lot of teachers will say, we're a family. But what I'll tell teachers is, that's great. We say that too. But if you're going to tell them we're a family, you best be ready to show them what a healthy family looks like. Because unfortunately, not all children have a healthy family. Some do, yeah. Some do not. And so, you know, as I define family with my kids, it's, you know, I said, I think that family kind of means that I care about you. I want what's best for you. And I got your back. Doesn't mean you have to be best friends with everybody in this room. Doesn't mean that you have to want to spend every single waking minute. You know, you don't, you know, want to go on the weekends and be with every single, you know, kid in your class. But that does mean still, I care about you. I respect you. I want what's best for you. And those kinds of things, then kids start to understand, yeah, that's what I would love if everybody in that class felt this way about me or that we did that for each other. So it really just helps them understand that what we're trying to create is something what's to their benefit, is what they really ultimately want.
I think that's such a key point. You're not looking at the child in isolation. You're seeing the context. You're building their context and you're giving them a sense of a belonging through these meaningful relationships that they're building along the way, which is so powerful. I love that. So what are some of the teaching methods that you bring to your students so that they can themselves be effective in engaging with focus and willingness in spite of having learning challenges?
Well, we do have students here from all different kinds of academic backgrounds. About a third of our students were students that were struggling. A third of our students were right there in the middle. And then a third were doing pretty well in their schools before they came here, which is pretty typical of most public school classrooms. And so there's lots of different ways that we engage with our students. One thing is that anytime I'm teaching content, I teach it in multiple ways, right? So that there's all different ways that they receive the information. So for example, oh gosh. All right. So I have to teach punctuation to my students, right? So some of people don't remember those comma rules because you glazed over when your teacher would just groan on and off, you know, or give you a packet of worksheets where you install all the commas. And so what I do, I mean, yes, there's a lot of written work here too, of course, but so I figured out I take referee hand signals and I attach them to punctuation marks. And so I'll put unedited sentences on the board and the students stand up and then they actually use their bodies to insert the punctuation as they're doing the sentence. And then on another day, they'll come in and when we're practicing some of the rules, you know, I will have explained the rules. I've done very traditional teaching, like this is what it looks like. Here's an example. Here's the rule. Here's why we have the rule. But then I have like little noisemakers, like cheap little party favors, like little tambourines and tiny little maracas and things. And each one represents a different punctuation mark. And so we'll read the sentence, but then they have to play for 2 seconds whenever they get to that punctuation mark that their instrument represents. And so it almost looks like a handbell choir. And then on another day, they may come in and when they're finally practicing and I've got watercolors. And so instead of just having a packet where they're writing, they're actually using watercolors to paint the punctuation marks on as they're going through and I'm walking around and I'm helping them and I'm checking and things like that. And or on another day, they've come in and I actually had this thing, like I said, it was Punctuationos. It's an Italian restaurant. And so I had just old cheap plastic tablecloths on the table, not much to it, and some Italian music. But I had all these different papers that had, you know, sentences that were not punctuated, but they used pasta to punctuate them, you know, like little elbow macaroni for commas and little spaghetti to underline.
Oh, I love that.
So even though there were days you come in here, it looks very traditional. See, throughout that, there were other things that I did using lots of different modalities and you know, lots of different learning styles and things like that. So by the end, if they don't know where those darn commas are, I mean, they know where those commas are. They did great because they've practiced it, but they want to get it right because the doing it is fun. You know, they want to play the right instrument. They want to do the right hand gesture. So I got to know those comma rules so that I'm not, you know, doing it at the wrong time and things like that. And so it's getting them excited about being right, about learning the information. That's just one example, but just popped in my head because we're about to start on doing all that.
Yes, could you sign me up, please? I have article deletion syndrome. I do how to put A and D.
And all these things, it's, you know, important. We're blessed with a very beautiful facility here, but that I'm in now. But we teach teachers things. I mean, everything I explained to you could be done with little borrowed cheap info. You know, it's not like you have to go out and buy. Teachers spend way too much money out of their own pockets on, as we've already said, minimal salaries. And so it's really just lots of different ways to get kids moving and engaged with the content. It helps. And it's not just for little kids. I mean, this is something that, you know, if you were here as an adult and I were teaching you these rules, you'd still enjoy getting up moving instead of just sitting still and staring at a board all day long. And so there's lots of multiple ways that we teach it.
You know, it's so funny. So I do group training for elementary, middle school, high school, and college students teaching executive function. And one of the things that I do is the same idea of not so much instruments, but if we are working on kind of something called schema analysis. So if you want to process complex information, you have to impose or see the underlying structure to information. And you understand that structure of information using various templates. So the getting children to be exposed to different types of informational templates is kind of creates this, you know, X-ray vision for you. And so I have a box in my office that over 20 years that I have, through my travels or experiences, I have gathered. And if you take those items in the box out of the context, you have no idea what it is because it doesn't have any identifying marker to it or any. Mm-hmm. And that, so for example, I have like these salt and pepper shakers that they give on airplanes, but they are like have a base and they don't have a hole. You have to remove a cap. If you don't know what that is, you have no idea what it is. And so we do lots of exercises where kids have to figure out the use and the context based on something that exists arbitrarily. But what I tell when I do my training of other speech language pathologists or educators, I say innovation is how do you apply a fundamental principle of teaching in a most creative way. So the students are second guessing not just your method, but also content, because the engagement comes from like, what are you trying to teach me? And you're using this, but they're so used to seeing worksheets, but now you have to get them away from worksheets. And so when you talk about Italian pasta, it is literally like they have to now start seeing commas everywhere, you know?
Right.
I used to, this is so dated, but when I did workshops that would be like 2-day workshops, I used to carry a phone book, old yellow pages, and I used to distribute to the audience. And I used to say, now we are going to design memory strategies using 2 pages of phone book. So they used to like freak out. No, there's nothing published. And I said, no, you don't need anything. You can create something because if you understand how to engage people that you are training or helping develop. So that's what I'm hearing you, that your inspiring teaching methods have an incredible application, but it's such a sound principle, then you're giving them opportunity to generalize in many, many contexts.
Yes.
So what are some of the powerful takeaways from your book that will transform teaching and learning for current and future generation that you highly endorse?
Well, my book, Talk to Me, is about the power of effective communication, because to me, that's at the heart of meaningful relationships, whether it be relationships with the teacher and the students, or students with one another, or teachers with one another, or communicating with our parents or other stakeholders. And so there are 6 principles that I teach. I know we don't have time to do all of them. I would say my first 2 are probably my favorite, but 6 principles are consideration, motivation, appreciation, validation, and then the art of conversation and celebration. But consideration is this mindset. It's the idea that there's always more to the story. You'll never know what somebody else is going through. You'll never understand completely what it is fully to walk through someone else's shoes. And so in the book, you know, I share a lot of stories where, you know, I walked into a situation perhaps thinking that this was the reality, to really learn that somebody was experiencing a totally different set of realities or stressors. And that was why that person behaved the way they did. And so it's really helpful if we go through life, if we always understand, we can never fully know what it is to be somebody else. Now, that doesn't mean you allow people to bully you, doesn't mean you allow people to mistreat you or that you lower expectations. But if you have a consideration mindset, it tempers the way that you approach conflict when there is conflict, but also in your day-to-day interactions, it really affects the way that you, your body language, your facial expression, your tone, how you deliver information. And it makes a big difference in the way that you see the world. And you don't get your feelings hurt so much. You know, sometimes if somebody says something, sometimes you can just wear that and carry that with you. But if you take into consideration, there could be a whole lot more to the story. I think it makes you a lot more reflective and maybe not so defensive. And then that leads into the second principle, which is motivation. You know, in our day-to-day interactions, whether we realize or not, there are motivators behind why we come to the table to meet with somebody. Now, if you're off with your friends, obviously your motivation is to bond, to get to know one another better. But in our day-to-day interactions, let's say you do have to sit down, you're an educator and you're sitting down with a parent. You're trying to come up with, you know, a solution of some time, right? We're trying to share information in some way. Sometimes we come to the table and our motivations are off. For example, sometimes let's say a parent wrote an email to a teacher and the teacher misinterpreted it, teacher felt defensive. So if I go into a conference and I'm feeling defensiveness, anger, frustration, ego, you know, those kind of insecurity, then that's going to come out in the words that I choose. It's going to come out in my body language, and then it's going to make it feel like there's conflict, even when maybe there doesn't need to be. And so there are a lot of positive motivators. Positive motivators are things like, you know, insight, wisdom, solutions, productivity, you know, kindness, goodness. Those are the positive influencers. But then there are also negative influencers like power, control, manipulation, ego, insecurity. And if you are going to the table with one of those being your motivators, it's going to come out and it's not going to go effectively. And I also talk about the fact that it's not the words you choose that are as meaningful as the sincerity with which you say them. You know, sometimes there are people, they say all the right words. They say everything you want to hear, but you don't trust them as far as you can throw them. Well, that's because intuitively, you know that they really have the wrong motivation. You know, they're out for themselves or they're trying to gain power or control or manipulate.
Yeah, I think the part that you talk about this presentation, what you say, how you say, I think I love that you are not only telling that again to teachers, but also you're making that transparent to the students because it has a direct bearing on second chances you get from your teacher, right? Sometimes like let's say you are having difficulties, but if your approach to your difficulties is a tantrum, or if your approach to your own challenges is meltdown, then the meltdown gets better or bigger attention than your need. And right. And so to become a self-advocate, you need to be aware of that. And so I really like that approach. I think you just mentioned this, but is this a good thing? Would you consider all these factors that you were describing that are they block the road to self-efficacy or effective classroom efficacy is the culture killers? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of things that we do that kill the culture in the classroom, whether it's if you're walking in and you're seeking control or power instead of just, you know, respect and joy. A lot of times if you are, you know, I even talk to school leaders about there's things that are pretty standard that are done that teachers will complain about or in any organization, you know, failure to speak in the hallway, failure to say hi, failure to look someone in the eyes and, you know, smile, things like that. There's such simple things, failure to give credit where it's due, failure to show appreciation, failure to really see people in the work that they're doing. All those different kinds of things are really barriers to creating a healthy climate and culture. Another one of the principles that I talk about in the book is validation. And really that's that whole idea of I see you. I really recognize all that you are doing. And if I don't know everything you're doing, I sit down to take the time and say, tell me about that project. Tell me everything you had to do to make this happen, because I am just amazed. You know, and you could do that with a child, you know, like, you know what, talk me through this essay that you wrote or this piece of work or whatever you've done. I said, I'm so impressed. Talk me from the very beginning to the end. Like, what did you have to do to come up with this idea? And how did you put all this together? And I just want to know, because I just have such an appreciation for it. And I'm just fascinated. Talk me through it. Then that person really feels seen. And it's even things too, when we talk about behavior, I know you're talking about positive behavior. It's like recognizing those positive behaviors. You know, I noticed today that I saw you in the lunchroom walk over and help somebody who needed help. And when you do that, that shows me you're going to be the kind of person in life who's always going to stop and notice people and be and assist them. And that's just a beautiful thing about your character.
See, and it's like almost like sounds to me, it's like a Zendo, you know, it's like a Zen monastery where everybody is anchored and there's a great sense of like equanimity because we recognize the humanity in each other. And that's such a powerful way to be. even when you feel stressed, you know somebody's going to see that stress and separate you from the stress. They're not going to think, oh my God, here comes the ball of anxiety, you know? And I love this, the part where you said getting them to explain the process or just to recognize how much hard work went into creating something. Sometimes we are so caught up in having children produce, we may not have the time to pause and acknowledge, other than we are evaluating or giving feedback about the product, but the process is celebrated, which is so empowering. So with that in mind, tell us a little bit about, we're doing this backward, but one quick question I had been thinking about is, what do teachers and educators get wrong when it comes to needs of learners? And so when, I bet you have some people in the audience, when they come to observe you and learn from your workshops, they're thinking, this is, you know, Kim, you think this is easy. Come to my school. We can do this. My principal is this way. My headmaster is this way. My other fellow teachers, nobody will have a buy-in. Oh, what do you say to them? What is stopping them from being open to making a difference from inside out?
Right. A lot of times they really are in some really challenging situations. And so, you know, I really do delve a lot into those relationship and that relationship building. And even if they can't, you know, I'm focusing on what they can do in their own classroom first. I think that's really, really important. But, you know, when you talk about the challenges that we have, I think there's a couple of things that pop in my head first. You know, one is that, you know, discipline is an issue. It's a big problem in a lot of schools, but a lot of times teachers frustrated, teachers angry at the kids. And so then it doesn't go anywhere and there's not a lot of movement. So for example, we do a lot of things with movement and energy in our classroom, getting our kids up to move. Like the punctuation example is just one small example. You know, I've had teachers say, well, if I did that with, you know, the boys in my class, they'd be out of control. And what I would say to them is respectfully, those are the exact reason you need to do it, because they need to move. You know, they're that behavior is that way because they've been sitting still and they're just not designed to sit still in that way.
Exactly.
You let kids get up, move. We as adults, everybody who's listening to this has had a day where you were sitting in a conference or something like that and you behave badly. You're making notes or text or doing something because you're like, I just cannot keep sitting here listening to this person drone on and on. We've all done that as adults, but yet we expect kids to be able to do that and it's even harder for them. So I think that that's a big thing. Another issue, though, is that there is a huge culture of low expectations. If you have a child who learns differently, it doesn't mean that you have low expectations for that child. You teach them differently. And high expectations, I like to say, they're the outward manifestation of your belief in someone. You see, if I have low expectations, what I'm really saying is, well, baby, I don't think you can do it either. And so we have very high expectations. Now, you don't just say, here's the expectation, get there. You have to provide the support and the structure and work with that child and be patient and that kind of thing. But you still have to set high expectations because that child has to function in a world where the expectations are high and the competition is high. And so there are a lot of beautiful, wonderful, loving, kind teachers who love their students dearly, but they make a misstep sometimes because they're like, oh, but his life is so hard. So I'm just going to do this instead. But that really isn't helping that child, because that child is going to not learn that work ethic. And sometimes, you know, we know that those kids who have to work the hardest, they're the ones that are the most successful. They're the ones you want to hire because they've got that grit and that determination, that work ethic, because they did have to meet those high expectations.
So do you think that the low expectations come from the culture of low expectation is fueled by socioeconomic background? Is there something to do with that? As a lot of research is talking about, that things are not made equal for every student.
I think that absolutely that can be one factor. I think that a teacher may feel like, well, this child doesn't. And, you know, and it's true, the child may not have been exposed to as many things prior to coming into that classroom. But that doesn't mean that, oh, I don't think you can do it. You know, I have three sons whom I adopted from Soweto, South Africa. Two of my sons were living in a garage when I met them. My sons, I adopted them. They arrived here at age 12. And my sons could not add. They could not multiply. My son Sisipo could not read. They speak five languages fluently, by the way, but they were not literate in them. And now my sons are all seniors in high school and they're all honor students.
Wow.
But
yeah, that's remarkable. Yeah.
Well, you know, they came from poverty, but it shows if you're in the right environment and you teach in multiple ways and you have the structures and you have the support, that even though they came from that poverty, they can still learn. So I had very high expectations. Ooh, it was a lot of hard work to get them to where they are today. But a lot of times some people might have said, well, you know what, bless their hearts, they came from that, so we can't expect that of them. And I'm like, no, we can. I'm going to expect that of them because I want a better life for them. And so I think that's where we misstep sometimes. Those expectations are important, but you, of course, have to provide the support to help it. You know, another thing that's a challenge in our classrooms is that 77% of teachers are white females. I am a white female. I know you can't see me right now, but I'm a white female. And there's, you know, so much statistics and data that, you know, even if a young boy of color, especially a young boy of color from poverty, has at least just one male teacher, just one of color, that he's significantly more likely to graduate from high school and to have success, just to have somebody who looks like him, who can understand him at a different level. Like, I love my children like I birthed them. I mean, every single child in this building, and they know I believe in them, and I challenge them, I care about them. But it's one of the things, too, we've got to get more people of color into education and more men in education, too. I think it's only 2% of educators are Black males, and all different types of diversity, because then that can help us, too, to seek to understand each other better, too. And understand, and, you know, the cultural relevant things that we need to know as teachers as well.
And, you know, just a sidebar, in my profession, speech language pathologists, speech language pathology and audiology, we are slightly above 200,000 people in the nation, and we have close to 94% of them are white women. So, yeah, and we are seeing this, we are seeing the same issues, because if we are serving children in or special need population, or a lot of these special needs students could be simply having experiences of disadvantages that come from growing up in poverty. Their role models are not necessarily somebody that looks like them. Right. And that can be really, really challenged, because, and the experiences, they may not have the shared experiences too.
Right.
So thank you for adding that little nuance there, because I think our practices need to change the way we hire, the way we prepare teachers, and then the way people seek teaching as a profession.
Right. Absolutely.
So as we end, you talked a lot about teachers and how they, what a way to be. What is your message for parents, and how do you prepare parents to be good partners with teachers?
So one thing that parents, sometimes we are, you know, I am a parent of four children. Sometimes we are so blinded by our love for our children that we can't see crazy in ourselves. we see it in other people, but then, you know, and I've done it too. There's every single parent on the earth. But one thing to know is that all kids, every child on this planet, sometimes will tell a mistruth. And all children make mistakes. I mean, I was a great kid. I had wonderful parents, but I lied to my parents sometimes because I didn't want to get in trouble. And, you know, and that doesn't make me a horrible person. And so one thing is to understand is that please know that if something doesn't add up or it doesn't sound right, not to go on the attack, but rather to say, you know, hey, my child came home and told me this is, and I just want to get clarification. Can you, you know, fill me in on what happened? Instead of just jumping to the conclusion that something happened, and accept if a teacher said, well, here's what your child did. Sometimes parents will say, well, is that really true? They look at it, but yeah, the teacher said it. You know. So one thing is really to understand that we're in this together, and even your precious, perfect baby could have done something wrong. I think that's really important to understand, and that we're in this together. But the other piece too, I see happening a lot, is that sometimes as parents, especially parents who are just overtired, we feel like, well, first of all, we wear the emotions of our children. And so on any given, if your child's happy, you're happy. If your child's sad, you're sad. If your child's upset, you're upset. And it's easier said than done, because I'm a parent, I get it. But when your child's upset, the best thing you can do is not be upset and be calm. Or if your child's hurting, try not, you know, if you're hurting, then don't let them see it. You know, go in your room, close the door, and then cry on that pillow. But when you're with them, they need your calm. They need you to be level. They need you to be a voice of reason. They need peace. They don't need the storm to be fueled. And the last thing I would say for parents is that sometimes parents will be embarrassed if their child made a mistake, right? They're like, oh my gosh, we've shamed the family. I can't go to open house now because you got detention. Yes. You know, it's just, and teachers, we don't think that way. Like if a kid did something wrong, that does not mean you're a bad parent. And so we got to work together as a team. Like, you know, I've had, you know, kids messed up because I've got real kids here. And I've said things to the mother, like, you know what? I know you raised him better. And I know that you did not raise him to tell a fib like that. And so I'm so glad he did it here, because we can work together as a team so that he knows it's not what to do. And this consequence is going to help him understand moving forward, this is not what to do. But please know, I think you're a great mom. You know, I mean, I think that we have to learn to validate each other and see you're doing a great job. This kid, we're in this together. Kid messed up, but life is not over. Family's not shamed. It's not like the child's never going to college because the child got in trouble in seventh grade. You know, so those are the kind of things I think that parents get hysterical about sometimes.
I love everything you're saying, and I wish this interview never ended. and I'm so truly so thrilled with the way you are presenting. You have presented this information, and I highly encourage our listeners to get both your books. And I know, as I hear through the grapevines, that you're working on your third one. So yes. I can't wait to see that come out. But truly, thank you, Kim, for everything you do for our children and the care and affection you put in it. And you have such incredible respect for their ability to rise above their learning needs and challenges, because they're here. They're here to grow into their own selves. And I think the inspirational message that you're saying, that everybody has the same access to beautiful future. So everybody may not have access to Kim, but everybody has access to reaching their personal best. So I thank you for being on this podcast and really helping us all learn more how to reach out to our best potential. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, so Cheda, I have to tell you, I want to go back to school and I want Kim to be my teacher.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. If you know of someone who might benefit from listening to this conversation, we would be grateful if you would kindly forward it directly to them. So on behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, today's guest, Kim Bearden, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, thanks for listening today. And we look forward to seeing you again right here next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.